Hello, my name's David Runciman, and this is Talking Politics. Today, a special extra episode with Ian McEwan, talking about his new novella, The Cockroach, which, as you'll hear, both is and isn't all about Brexit. Talking Politics is brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary for the next few months with an unimprovable offer. Get a year's subscription and a limited edition LRB tote bag for just £40 by using the URL lrb.me/birthday. We recorded this conversation with Ian in London. It was the night after the very, very heated Commons debate, in which Boris Johnson said one or two things that we're going to refer to that raised the temperature even higher. But we started by talking about just how extraordinarily well-timed this book is. So, you know, I read this on the afternoon of the Supreme Court judgment, which happened in the morning, and it felt like you must have written it in real time. It was uncanny, and there were some really unnerving bits. So as I was reading it, Johnson was responding in New York, where he was, and he said that kind of, I accept what the judges think. And then he went straight into his kind of, but Britain in 2050 is going to be the greenest, funnest, bounciest, with flying cars and space stations on the moon.
Yes.
And you have a couple of the, so when, you can't have written it as I was reading it, but it felt, when did you write it?
I wrote it in August.
So how did you know?
Well, actually, if you look in Hansard, 26th of July, there's Johnson in a kind of priority statement, which I thought I could satirise, but then I realised I couldn't. So I lifted it more or less whole scale. I told the publishers, I said, do you expect any copyright problems? And they said, no. Yes, we're going to be the home of the electric airplane. And we're going to be first in not wrecking our precious planet. And then a list of aspirations, and there was not a single one of them that you could not do without. If you were in the EU, they would not stand in your way. If you want to be the home of the electric battery, what's stopping you?
And then he gave his United Nations speech, which, did you see it? There was sort of, your mattress will spy on you in your sleep and your fridge will talk to your toothbrush. And again, yeah. I think it's not satirizable.
No, I think it's quotable. Damnation via quote is the only way with that. I mean, the Hansard speech, which I recommend, as Freud said to the Gestapo, to all my friends, was a very pithy statement of something deeply contradictory. And I think where it points us is I no longer hear any economic or even sovereignty arguments for Brexit. We have moved now into the mystic, as Van Morrison might say. We're in a mystical realm. We must leave because we said we would. We must leave because. And so that's why I build that into the conversation that my prime minister has with the Chancellor of Germany.
And was there a moment in the last few months, it came to you that the Kafka story could be turned on its head? Did you have a kind of flash, or was it something you'd been thinking about for a while?
I drifted into it. It must have been in July. I thought, well, maybe I can't see any way into Brexit. It just seems too big for fiction, too extraordinary and strange for satire. But then I found myself writing a version of the first line of Kafka's Metamorphosis. And then I thought, well, I'll play with this for a while. I wrote the first paragraph. And then I thought, well, I'll write a short story. And so I wrote a short story of about 5,000 words. Then I had to go on my travels for Machines Like Me. But it was haunting me the whole time. I thought, maybe this is the way in. Something so absurd. Just get out of the real, into that zone in which I think many of us feel we're in, where it's so strange, so unpredictable, so compelling. And I can see that one great division in the country is between those of us who are total junkies for this, who wake every morning, start at 6 o'clock with the Today programme, read all the press, and those who just say, I can't take any more.
And according to polling, the majority who say, just want it over. Yeah. Don't care, just want it over.
It will never be over. I mean, I'm very gloomy about this. The idea of a clean break, or that we walk away and then it's over, of course, is delusional. But I understand that impulse. And I hear many of those vox pops. People say, just get on with it. Let's just get out of it. But the language before last night, the language of got to pitchfork this incubus off our back, or the Incredible Hulk break the shackles stuff, is so puerile. And it's now kind of right in this mainstream of our language about this, that when the 11 Supreme Court judges, when Lady Hale delivered the judgment, it was a brief respite. It was as if 11 grown-ups had come to collect you from one of the rowdiest, most unpleasant 7-year-old birthday parties you were ever at. You know, take me home, put me to bed. But that was so brief, that little plateau. I punched the air. I even had a little tear in my eye. I thought, God, what a lucid, extraordinarily balanced judgment this is. Strong on its historical sense, dignified, and delivered in a language everyone could understand. It was just absolutely a marvellous moment. And then what happens? We're in Parliament, and then we're into a punch-up of a new kind. So it was a brief respite.
I found myself thinking of another of your books on the day of the Supreme Court judgment. So The Children Act is one of those rare books that deeply humanizes a judge. I was trying to think, I don't think there are many. There's the Jane Gardam Old Filth. But it's actually quite rare to have a judge fully fleshed out, fully humanized. And there were these 11. So Lady Hale is someone that people now have an interest in.
I've taken a long interest in her because she was head of the family division. And when we were making the movie of the Children Act, we all crowded into her office. And Emma Thompson, who's going to play the judge, then spent some time sort of shadowing Lady Hale as she went about her business. Emma said, I don't want any old judge. I want a woman. I want a lady to be with, because you know, it is a very male atmosphere. The family division is slightly different. So I was always impressed by her, and I'd read one or two of her judgments when I was researching the novel. A lot of these judges have very good prose. Mm. So that was a big moment. I think they didn't only deliver a judgment, they made law. And I think it's a big constitutional moment. I think Parliament is empowered. And I think looking for an optimistic side of that savage exchange last night and the rowdiness, I think you're seeing a Prime Minister backed against the wall, completely powerless, no majority. And Parliament now, they didn't really come across yesterday, but Parliament is massively empowered by that judgment.
So the other 10, the relatively faceless judges about whom we know very little, but you could, you know, a great novelist could flesh them all out. But the contrast between them, about whom we know nothing, and the politicians last night, Johnson, where it's almost impossible. I mean, I don't know whether you can, when you look at it, to imagine. So we've got a novel here which has the insect inside the man, but to imagine what's going on. I mean, can you get inside his head? So when he says the way to honour the memory of Joe Cox is to do Brexit, can you get inside his head?
I think it was an ill-considered remark. I mean, I guess all of us on our feet, unless we're
really... And he'd been on his feet for a couple of hours.
Yeah, you're bound to say something really profoundly stupid, and that was completely nuts. I mean,
do you think he might think it?
No.
Do you think it's cynical?
Well, I think he has taken a decision, clearly, somewhere between New York, or maybe even while he was in New York, that it's best to tough this out.
Everything that goads the opposition is a...
Yes, and go over the heads of Parliament to the people. It's Trumpian, boneheaded populism, of course. And the difference between that and Lady Hale's judgment, or the Supreme Court's judgment, she's referring to issues of 1611 and 1688. So we're not only in the present. There's this other dimension, a rich kind of sense that James, as king, is the government of the time, divine right, etc. So what happened then is of issue, is of consequence. When, for example, in the novel, reversalism, or its Brexit parallel, has to be got through, and they do it by tricking the opposition with a pairing arrangement. When Jim Sams comes back to England, and we've got the whole thing through, it's a great success because 40 opposition people are not there for the vote. They're absent in the lobby. when Jim Sims has to justify himself to the BBC, long conversation on Newsnight, he says, well, there's a long honourable tradition. We don't have a written constitution, but there's a long honourable tradition of cheating. When I heard the government lawyer, was it Edie or the other one, I can't remember, say on the last day of that hearing, well, other people have prorogued Parliament for political purposes. John Major did it, someone else did it, someone else did it. And no one actually stood up and said, yeah, but it was wrong. He simply said, there's a long honourable tradition of doing this terrible thing, which is silencing Parliament when it suits you.
And that's and how I we thought, do things
so
in this
I thought,
country.
I punched the air again. I thought, yeah, I got it right with the pairing. You argue that we're a wretched bunch of human beings and we've set up some decent precedents. But to hear that judgment read out aloud in these rather unassuming tones, I was just transfixed. It's
brief,
the best
briefly
thing
transfixed.
That happened to me in public life for a very long time.
Talking Politics is brought to you in partnership with the London Review of Books.
Hi, it's Catherine, the producer of the podcast, here to tell you quickly about two live events that we're doing this month. The first one is on the 5th of October, that's a Saturday. We're appearing as part of Politics Live, a day-long podcast and politics festival near King's Cross in London. You can buy a ticket for the whole day or just for us. The second one is on the 16th of October in the evening in Cambridge. It's part of the Cambridge Festival of Ideas. David and Helen will be joined by Aisha Hazarika, stand-up comic, Ed Miliband's ex-right-hand woman, full of Westminster punditry and gossip. There'll be beer at that one and some limited edition merchandise to celebrate our third birthday that we might just be giving away. All the information on how to buy a ticket will be in the show notes for this episode. Thanks.
So you mentioned reversalism, which is the Brexit substitute. I love it. I'm not going to try and explain it. Just give us the reversalism pitch. How would you sell it to the people?
Well, I can only describe it. So the idea is basically that you reverse the money flow. So you basically you pay for your job. If you have a job at the end of the week, you have to give money to your employer. How do you afford your job? You have to shop. The more you shop, the richer you get. But you cannot hoard money. So if you let's say a hotel, you really want to buy the best sheets, the best flowers for the rooms, best furniture. The more you shop, the more money you have. And when you employ musicians, they will be paying you. But you're not allowed to keep that money. So you must expand.
So consumer demand goes up inexorably.
Oh, yeah. And
we can never stop shopping.
Parts of the left think, well, that might be rather good for the unemployed. They've got nothing to do all day but shop. And get very rich.
They don't have to pay for a job.
But at one point, you know, the foreign secretary says, well, I earn £141,510 a year. How can I afford this job? I don't have any time to do any shopping. And one of his colleagues says, well, buy a Tesla or two. The trouble with this strangely neglected, highly rational form of economics is when you come to trade with other nations. So far in the novel, they've only signed up St. Kitts and Nevis. Basically because, you know, if the Germans are going to send us BMWs and Mercedes, they've got to stuff them with cash. And they seem sort of boneheadedly reluctant to do that. I was trying to think of something as self-harmingly absurd as Brexit. I'm not sure I succeeded, to be quite honest.
So,
Some people got quite enthusiastic about Brexit.
What I liked about it, it's got a kind of 18th century feel to it. So it's quite Gulliver's Travels. It's sort of,
yeah.
And also the 18th century, there were some really wacky schemes about money. It's the kind of thing actually you can imagine in the 18th century. But I think in the 18th century, it would be a sort of, insofar as it was a satirical idea, it would be a satire of human folly. It would be kind of, we're all inherently capable of believing this stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
whereas for you, it's something that is sort of sold to people. I mean, that's the 18th century version. It wouldn't be a democratic satire. It would just be like, we're human, and this is the kind of stuff that humans wind up believing.
I mean, the Greeks did have a word for it, akrasia, passionate and self-harming certainties.
That people get caught up and they come in a kind of bubble, you know, the classic 18th century bubbles as well.
And probably the greatest of those satires is Swift's Modest Proposal. And those are the shoulders one stands on, I think, when you write political satire.
Is Brexit human folly or is it political folly? Is there something in all of us that's capable of...
Well, if you go back just 5 or 6 years and we weren't talking about Brexit, except politicians on the right, and I know it's been evoked many times, but say, go back to 2012, in the few weeks after the Olympics, we were feeling quite good about ourselves. People weren't saying en masse, well, it was a great Olympics, but if only if we were out of the EU, they would have been even better. So it's now become a passion. And as I said, it's become religious in tone. I could understand economic self-harm if you were making an argument for sovereignty. But I can't see any arguments for more sovereignty. Take back control is a colossal lie. Every trade deal we're going to do around the world is going to be a compromise with sovereignty. All trade deals are chipping away at your sovereignty. Our membership of NATO is a compromise with sovereignty. The Good Friday Agreement, the Paris Accords. We've got to live among nations. There will be no more sovereignty post-Brexit than there was before it. And we will be going around the world doing deals, diminishing our sovereignty again. People won't have more control over their lives. And the other side of that is that, just forgetting the fact we've already got 70-odd trade deals, you know, getting back there is going to take us 20 years and a lot of political capital. But subsidiarity in the EU and the fact that you've got this extraordinary cluster of diverse nations. I mean, I once went to Slovenia with a friend to do some trout fishing and hiking. We went to the most remote bit. We hired a car and drove west. And we were looking for our turnoff. We couldn't find it. And then suddenly we realized we were in Austria. And my heart leapt. I thought, wow, how wonderful. Here we are on the Eastern Front. We know less about the savagery in the First World War of the Eastern Front, but everyone there, Italians and Austrians, remember it all too well. And I thought, well, we could actually point our... We could go up towards Schleswig-Holstein and go to Sweden, or we could turn left and go to the very southern tip of Spain. And no one would ask to see our passports. What an incredible achievement when you think back to the ruin mid-20th century of Europe. And it's so much more interesting to take a road trip in Europe than it is in the United States, which is so homogenous now, apart from its glorious landscapes.
And its political divisions.
And its political divisions. So at the consumer level or the architectural level, there's nothing to compare with the rich diversity. And Sweden remains Sweden, and France remains France. And Britain actually is very much a different place from all of those and still could be a member of the EU. So it does seem to me like a strange and crazy project, but we have to take it very seriously because people voted for it. But no one can remember quite why.
With those sort of 18th century manias and bubbles, they burst. I mean, that's part of the way the cycle works. And I think with reversalism, possibly there would be a moment where the bubble bursts. Do you have any confidence that there will come a point where the illusion bursts?
I'm not so sure it's going to be catastrophic. I think it might well be dreary.
And drawn out.
And if there's an awakening, it's going to be very, very slow and much contested. I mean, we don't agree with each other on how to describe the present. Others will say we're doing marvellously, and others people say, yeah, but what about, you know, whatever, waiting lists for hip operations? So I think that'll be a very, very slow process. And yes, one day a centrist party might arise and start negotiating our way back. But I think we'll sort of negotiate our way back by little instances, a mosaic of all the arrangements we have in security, in culture, in science. They'll all be put back. They won't be quite as good as they are now, but they'll go on functioning. On immigration, we need our strawberry pickers. We need the cash cow of foreign students at university. We need people to help us out in the health service. And social care is such a huge issue with so many of us getting older. We'll either take immigrants from the Commonwealth or we'll take them from the EU. You will not see down the high street seas of white faces that some, I think, older voters expect to get back to some other time. My guess is, and I probably won't be around to collect any money on this, but it'll be a more like a kind of plus ça change, you know, a little bit drearier, after maybe some bumps in the road, as they call it, if we go for a no deal or end up with a no deal. But, you know, a waste of intellectual, political, emotional capital on a scale that is hard to really think of in historical terms.
So you mentioned that you thought of and wrote this book while you were out there talking about Machines Like Me, which is a great book. It's a great political book, apart from anything else. And we had tried to get you on our podcast to talk about that a while back.
Oh, sorry about that.
No, and so we can't do the AI conversation. But there are a couple of things I want to ask you that connect it with this.
Right.
So it's this great counterfactual, it's a counterfactual book, both about science, the contingency of science and scientific discovery, but also the contingency of politics. So in this story, Margaret Thatcher loses the Falklands War, and she doesn't resign.
She makes her famous "I take it on my shoulders" speech.
And I remember thinking when reading it, it's a really interesting question. Would she have? Now, we've got a prime minister now who I think, if he does resign, it'll be for tactical reasons,
yes,
but it's not going to be for what you might call Lord Carrington reasons.
Shame. Yeah.
This is a straight question. It really started me thinking about it. If Margaret Thatcher had lost the Falklands War, would she not have resigned?
Well, when you think how popular it was to send the task force, most of the country was for it. And we didn't use the word at the time, but myself and all my friends, with one very, very clear exception.
Whom you won't name.
No, I'm going to name.
Oh, great.
We're all against it. But the country was so overwhelmingly for it that she might well have just gauged that mood and say, we're all to blame. And she takes it on her shoulders for the country. That was my supposition on that. But then staggers on and loses then to Tony Benn.
Who then,
as a Brexiteer, takes us. I was at that Labour Party conference, the Healy-Benn moment. There was a punch-up in the bar in the Grand Hotel. These were in the days when before the bombing.
So this is to go back, this is Plowman's Lunch era, your great screenplay.
Yes, yes, yeah. So you could go into the bar of the Grand Hotel and you'd be hanging out with cabinet ministers or shadow cabinet ministers. And I remember when the vote came through and Healy had won, there were some very fierce trots in the bar. It was like a sort of Wild West punch-up began. You know, when you have balsa wood banisters and, you know, the piano falls over and so on.
So it makes the Tom Watson stuff look tame.
Oh, right? Yeah.
That's just...
My great dissenting friend, because he always loved a good war, was Christopher Hitchens.
Cool. I was going to guess.
And he said, no, you've got it all wrong. This is an anti-fascist war. And if we get over there and give them a good hiding and take back the islands, it'll be the end of fascist government. And he was right. If we had lost that war, the junta might still be in place.
And then in his time, she definitely should go.
Yes. So...
It's the joy of counterfactual history.
David, I was trying to write a novel about AI.
I know you were. And that's. I would love to have that conversation too.
I got into this... what fun it would be, you know, to think about Tony Benn taking us out without a referendum.
Yeah, through Parliament.
Yeah, referendums, plebiscites are for the Third Reich. And I imagine that, yes, my old friend E.P. Thompson might be at his side saying, you know, because he had this little romantic view of a Britain, but I think he really meant England, standing alone with a kind of Falstaffian partisan army. We didn't need to be sort of involved in anything else. And he was certainly a great anti-nuclear campaigner. So, yeah, Mrs. Thatcher comes out of Downing Street. There, because the Exocets have been armed by the French, by two Israelis, murdered by MI6.
Smart machines, the Exocets, right? In this.
Yeah. In fact, because Turing has put up his facial recognition software as open source, this is the problems of unintended consequences, the RGs are able to pick off the fleet. And so 3,000 people are dead. The rest of the fleet limps back to a hero's welcome. And the sorrow is enormous. And Mrs. Thatcher survives, but only for a bit.
So thinking counterfactually about the Brexit situation, I mean, one of the great puzzles of it is I think we can all see it's so contingent, you know, so many little things, and it feels so baked in. I mean, we're in that nightmarish moment in politics where we all know that the Cleopatra's nose moments are limitless, and yet we feel completely trapped by this sort of determined, over-determined present. can you get out of it and get into a counterfactual frame of mind of it? Can you still see the complete contingency of it? Or do you feel like we are now?
Just... I think of Schrödinger's cat. You know, the cat is both alive and dead until you lift the lid and it's one or the other. And the quantum reality collapses of the other thing. And I keep thinking, could I wake up one morning and find, actually, I've just been, it's a dream. You know, this is not where we're going. It's been a perfect storm, a perfect terrible storm, in that we have a Labour leader who was a leaver just at a time when we needed some solid opposition, voting with the government right at the beginning to press the button to get the clock ticking on.
Calling for it on the day of the morning of the result? First one to call for it?
Instead of saying, well, we want to know what your plan is. And this weird trope developed of a card game, that dealing with the EU was like playing poker and you mustn't show your hand. So the government was not speaking to us about what it wanted, because that was a state secret. The speed with which this was accepted. Meanwhile, the EU was saying, well, here is what we want, this, this, and this, especially in Ireland and so on. No hard border, customs union, etc. must remain intact. And it's no cherry picking and so on. We knew exactly where they stood. A good opposition would have said, we want to know where the government stands in this and hold them to account and discuss it. And actually, given that the division of the country was quite close on this very foolish process, we could have started off with a much clearer idea of where we were going. Great misfortune to have an ineffectual Prime Minister like Theresa May, who bent with the right of her party at a point when the country was fairly evenly divided. So those are the shakings of the butterfly wings, I think, in those early points. Of course, you go back to the piece that I can't wait to read that you've written about David Cameron's book.
And it does ask some of these questions.
You could go back further to Blair, who I think has a hand in this, and Gordon Brown, in not allowing 7 years to pass before we had migrants from the accession countries. We could have gone with France, Italy, and Germany and said, let them raise their economies. And it was a very decent EU rule. We might not have had austerity. I mean, anyone who was suffering from wage stagnation and all the rest of it was never going to press a button for the status quo. So there are many butterflies in this.
But it's not a dream.
It is not a dream, and we can't wake from it either.
Imre Kuhn's book is The Cockroach. The other books that we talked about, Machines Like Me, The Children Act, we will tweet the links to those too. We are going to be talking with Helen next week about the article that Ian referred to there, David Cameron's biography, and the question of when, why, and how the referendum actually happened. My name is David Runciman, and we've been talking politics.